Well, we are together to consider the idea of a godly family, which begins, of course, with a godly marriage. And I find pretty explicit instructions about how to build a godly marriage in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verses 1 through 7, a passage that is no doubt very familiar to you. And we will focus our attention this morning on the specific instructions that God gives us in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, about how to build a strong and a godly marriage. And of course, he begins where most modern society diverges from the biblical pattern for marriage to talk about the wife's role in 1 Peter 3 and verses 1 through 2 as we attend to that at the beginning of the lesson. One of the things that I find pretty amazing in the world of which we live today is the attempt to negate the differences that exist between men and women, regardless of how perverted that form takes in the world. One of the things that is exceedingly clear, I think, to most people is that men and women have some significant behavioral, psychological differences that are not just a matter of training, but are a matter of the way in which God has created us. And that comes to bear most significantly in the intimate relationship that exists between a man and a woman. And clearly, God, who has created us and knows us through and through, and has created laws that are good for us, has created marriage in such a way as to make the most benefit of the differences between men and women as they come together in a marriage relationship. There are different roles for husbands and wives in a marriage. And the Bible doesn't attempt to, certainly 1 Peter doesn't attempt to justify that, just takes that for taken for granted fact of life. And if we were just to observe the world around about us without filtering it through modern sort of psychological nonsense, it's obvious to us that men and women are different. We can spend some more time talking about that, but clearly that's the presumption with 1 Peter 3. And as we read in 1 Peter 3 and verse 2 about the role of wives, we find even further objections on the part of modern society, but their objections have nothing to do with what God has instructed us in our own lives, in our relationship with Him, and in our relationship with one another, and certainly in the relationship of marriage. 1 Peter 3, verse 1, in the same way, you wives be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. When Peter says the Holy Spirit is leading him in a similar manner, you go back through the first part of 1 Peter, and it is talked about various relationships in which we sense there's an unfairness. The unfairness of the government's persecution of Christians, the unfairness of masters over their slaves, the unfairness in personal relationships. And it says that in all those relationships, we are to submit ourselves to those circumstances and to behave as Christ would have us to behave. In like manner, having looked at all those unfair situations, he says to the wives, in a like manner, you're to be submissive to your husbands. And of course, the world immediately stands up and raises their objections to that the wife should be in submission to her husband. It is no accident that God starts here with this kind of instruction, because it's not just a modern phenomena that women have difficulties with this role in which God has assigned them. It goes all the way back to the beginning of creation. Beginning of creation, God said that he created men and women different and gave them these different roles. Genesis 2 and verse 18, it's not good for the man to be alone, and he needs a helper, and I will make one that is suitable to him, comparable to him, but suitable to him as a helper. And of course, many people read that and they presume then that women are just adjuncts to men, that they are inferior to men. That's not at all what that passage says. God makes a helper. He makes somebody who can get the job done. I am constantly amazed at my wife and her capabilities. And I constantly appreciate the fact that even with her competencies and her capabilities and her emotional strength, that she, in fact, is willing to fulfill the roles that God has given us in a marriage relationship. All would have been well, of course, except for the sin that separated us not only from God, but separated us from our own essential godly nature. And after the sin in the garden, Genesis 3 and verse 18 points out that this difference between men and women has now been corrupted, as so much has been corrupted. And as he says to the woman, because of the sin, then I'm going to greatly multiply your pain in children. In pain, you will bring forth children. Women always have had that capability of bringing forth children, and that would have been a perfectly peaceful, I think, circumstance. It would have been a blessing, unmitigated by sorrow, but because of sin, like so many other things in the world, we find mixed blessing and sorrow together in the things that we experience. And so birth is a painful process. Multiplied pain that was unnecessary, but was brought about by sin. But then he goes ahead to say, yes, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. And there are many kinds of interpretive approaches to that passage. But clearly what he's saying is, like with childbirth, your relationship with your husband was supposed to be one of blessing, but now it's going to be complicated by the fact of sin. You're still going to desire your husband and his leadership, and yet you're going to resist that, and you're going to feel some kind of subjugation and some kind of unfairness in that relationship. And indeed, that continues to be the course of marriages and male-female relationship throughout history. Read whatever kind of literature you want. There are periods of time in which you can pick out pieces of literature that demonstrate the objection that women have to this role that God has given them. Even today, of course, women feel this kind of ambivalence, and many of them will say, well, if I had the right kind of husband, I could live that way. For the right kind of man, I could do that. And I would suggest that those of you who are unmarried, consider that. If you were going to get married, the godly plan for marriage is for wives to be in submission to their husbands. You better make sure that you marry somebody that you're willing to be in submission to, that you can trust to submit to. But of course, here Peter is talking not to the unmarried, but to the married. And he says, even when it is unfair, in a like manner, you should be submissive to your husband, regardless of whether you think it is fair or not. The right kind of man, like Abraham, one of the great heroes of faith. We are all the children of Abraham. And then many children had Abraham, and I'm one of them. I'm thankful. But, in fact, when you read the story of Abraham, you recognize that Abraham was not quite the kind of husband that most people would want to have. Twice he lied about his relationship with his wife, Sarah, and got her into almost serious trouble, except for the intervention of God. And more than that, Abraham was always doing strange things. He pulled up stakes and left the land of Haran, and he went into the land of Canaan, and he wandered around and lived in tents, and he was always building altars, and he was always fleeing from one group or another. And Abraham was not exactly the kind of husband that most of us would want to have. And a lot of people will say, a lot of women will say, in that relationship, it's unfair. It's unfair that the husband gets to make decisions and I have to be in submission. And of course, we have to recognize that goes right back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 18. Yeah, your desire is going to be for your husband, and yet you're going to feel it's unfair when he rules over you. In Ephesians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul tries to help us understand those things by relating the marriage relationship, man and woman, to the relationship between Christ and the church. And he says in Ephesians chapter 5, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, also wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. And of course, when you read that passage, seen this many times in Bible classes, you know, they read that, and the husband will lean over and whisper, wife, see, you're supposed to do what I tell you to do. She'll nudge him in the rib and say, pay attention to what's going on. But somehow there's a sense of that affair that unfair that I have to do what he says and he doesn't have to do what I say, and we have this distinct feeling about fairness. But the truth of the matter is, God understands exactly what he is doing when he says the wife is to obey her husband, and the husband is to love his wife. Every pair ultimately is going to have disagreements. Any two people who live together know how incompatible they are, and they live together, they're going to have some disagreements with one another about something or another. And when they have a disagreement, sometimes they are just so certain they're right, how are they going to come to some kind of adjudication of that? In work, if you have a disagreement with a coworker and you can't resolve it, and that happens quite frequently, the boss gets to decide who's right. If you're talking about neighbors and they have some disagreement over the boundary line between them and they can't resolve it between them, you got a judge who's going to make some decision about that. If you've got two siblings and they're arguing with one another and they can't come to an agreement, you got a parent to adjudicate that issue. You got a husband and a wife and they're arguing with one another, they're just going to rip one another apart because they don't have anybody to make an adjudication. My grandfather, who was a great cynic, used to suggest that marriage is like taking two cats, tying their tails together, and hanging them over a clothesline. And they just fall one another to pieces. And some marriages look like that. And God said, I don't want that to happen. So husbands, you get to decide. You're the tiebreaker. You get to decide. And of course, the wife's saying, well, that's unfair. Why don't I get to decide? Why don't I get to be the tiebreaker? In fact, God said, I'll take care of that. Husbands, you get to decide. But you'd better decide what is in the best interest of your wife. You should love your wife in the same way that Christ loved the church, willing to die for the church. You don't impose your will on her for your own selfish purposes. Now, that does not mean that the husband has to do what the wife wants him to do. He has to do, however, what in his judgment is best for her, regardless of whether it's best for him or not. That's the kind of tie-breaking that God has put into the marriage relationship. And you too. Would you rather be the one who has to submit to the decision of the other? Or would you rather be the one who has to make that decision, even if it's contrary to what you think you would want, because it's best for your spouse? God has weighed those responsibilities in a way that man could not. And if you want to have a happy marriage, that's what you better learn to do. He also goes ahead to say that the wife should win her husband without a word, but through her chaste conduct. And the point is, sometimes husbands are not acting the way they're supposed to, and it's unfair. And the wife is not duty-bound to teach him better. She is to win him over by her chaste conduct. Even if the guy's like Abraham, or worse than Abraham, completely irascible, irritable, and ornery, he probably isn't blind. He can see the difference between this kind of chaste, submissive behavior and the kind of person who gets their own way and is going to re-give them equally and get back in kind. Now, this kind of chaste behavior is going to change his behavior. And it might not be sudden, like some kind of violent earthquake that splits everything apart and transforms the landscape, more like the gradual erosion of a stream bed. She will have an impact on him over time because of her chaste behavior. This kind of changing his behavior by her kindness is not to be like some kind of vengeance in reverse vengeance in Romans chapter 12. Apostle Paul says, don't avenge yourself, but rather give place to wrath, for it's written, vengeance is mine, and I will repay, says the Lord. If in fact your enemy is hungry, then feed him. If you thirst, then you should give him a drink. For in doing this, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Don't be overcome with evil, but overcome evil. Sometimes, maybe this tendency, I'm just going to suffer as a martyr, and he's going to be really bad when he finally realizes what he's done to me. That's not the point here at all, to make him feel bad. The point is to win him over to a better character by being the right kind of person yourself. Vengeance belongs to the Lord. Don't be overcome by evil, even if it's in this subtle, manipulative kind of way. You need to overcome evil with good. And the reason this behavior is going to be significant is because he's going to observe it. We live in close proximity. He can't avoid seeing it. But more than just casually seeing it, it's worth studying. That's what this word means. It means to study her behavior. Her behavior is a Bible lesson every single day. He can't avoid it. It's in his way. It's in his face. It is in his own home every single day. And that's the way you change your husband, if he isn't behaving the way he ought to. I know it's unfair. Lots of things in life are unfair, but that doesn't change your responsibilities. You need to be careful about trying to change your husband in any other way than that. Women, particularly, are good at manipulation and manipulation of men. Men sometimes are not so good with emotions, and they're not so good with words as women are. Women understand circumstances sometimes, for the most part, better than men. They have this indirect means of controlling men. They can win them over. They can manipulate them. They can get his emotions in such a way that he'll do exactly what they want him to do. But the result of that is, if that's the way she goes about trying to change her husband, is he's going to resent her. Somehow he figures out I'm being manipulated, and she's going to lose respect for him because she's manipulating him. Don't manipulate him. You should, in fact, change his behavior by your chaste, godly conduct. And you change his behavior not like Rebecca, you know, who engaged in this kind of charade to try and get her favorite son the blessing from Isaac. You engage in chaste, godly behavior. I don't know what the outcome is between the parents after that event took place, but it couldn't have been good when she's manipulated him in that way. And certainly that's the point of the story. And wives do not manipulate their husband by words. You don't teach him by preaching to him. You're teaching by behaving the way that you ought to behave. You don't engage in nagging. Interesting. I don't know whether some of you enjoy that or not. The history of words, etymology of words, where did they come from? Because some of them have kind of a strange, complicated history. Nagging in English is one of those words that has an interesting history. It goes back to the period of the bubonic plague. And particularly in Scandinavia, they had the word for rats chewing, because the rats, of course, carried the fleas, carried the bubonic plague, and so they were all over the villages, and they didn't have electric lights, so at night it got dark, and the rats would come out, and you could hear them just gnawing, gnawing, gnawing. And the word in the Scandinavian countries was knocking. Nogging, 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 nogging. And that turns out to be what the word nagging is, just nogging, nogging, nogging. Until you get it to do what you want to or just throw up his hands and give up altogether. Do not engage in that kind of nagging. As the wise man said in Proverbs 27 and verse 29, a continual dripping on a very rainy day is like a contentious thing. You can't ever get away from. You know, that's what they used apparently as one of the early forms of brainwashing. And you can brainwash your husband, that's for sure, but the end result is not going to be positive. You want to change his behavior, change it with chaste conduct. And then he says in verses 3-5 some other characteristics that the wife should pay attention to. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 3, your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a quiet and a gentle spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. And once again, he encompasses this idea of a parent with the idea of being in the proper relationship with your husband. Now, of course, the obvious implication of this passage is that external beauty is not of paramount importance. Spiritual beauty is what is principally important. The word adornment, however, let your adornment be in the internal spiritual heart, is to indicate the importance of the way in which you appear to other people and the way in which you appear particularly to your husband. It's certainly true that our society is just excessively fascinated with physical appearance, and men in particular have trained themselves or have given in to the natural selfish inclination of the lust of the eyes to be trained to pay attention to women only on the basis of external appearance. But what's really happening here is that we are some things that we learn to like, and there's some things that we learn not to like so much. And men need to learn this lesson here in this case. They need to learn to be careful what they like in the appearance of women. Because the women, you know, sometimes they dress for themselves, sometimes they dress for the appearance of other people, sometimes they dress for men. But the lesson here for the men is you need to be careful what you learn to like. Or you're going to be attracted to the wrong kind of a person, the wrong kind of a woman. You need to pay attention not to the external adornment, but to the internal spirit, because that's where the real person is. In fact, as I just reverberates in my head from my aunts and uncles and grandparents and my parents, beauty is as beauty does. That pretty is skin deep, ugly is the bone. That beauty fades away, ugly holds its own. The character is much more permanent than the external appearance. Now, everybody has been gifted by God with the perfect form or with the perfect clear skin or the exquisite hair or delicate features, but she can evidence in her adornment in the way in which her soul and her character expresses itself in her eyes and in her smile and in her conversation and in the choice of dress. She can express her inner character in such a way that that's an adornment that attracts the interest of the right kind of man, that makes it apparent that this is a worthy woman. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, in verse 9, Paul says, I want women to adorn themselves in proper clothing, modestly. And of course, there's a difference between the flaunting of physicality of a person and the clothing in such a way that expresses the character of a person. Modesty is the word that we choose for that. And of course, we could have all kinds of debates over what exactly is modest and where the line is, and whether that's a variable line depending upon social values. Probably, clearly, that's the case. But as the old adage is, you know, a Christian is not the first to take up a new kind of fashion, nor the last to lay the old aside. That somehow there is a choice of clothing that we can make, a choice of adornment, of makeup, of jewelry, that says to people, this is the kind of person that I am. And we want to do so in such a way as to indicate a proper kind of modesty, humility in the presence of the world. In Proverbs 31 and verse 25, we're told of the worthy woman that strength and dignity are her clothing. Dignity, not superficiality. What are you emphasizing with the kind of clothing that you wear and the appearance that you present to the world? Is it about the things that are of eternal value or the things that are only of temporary value? Incorruptible, Peter says here. Outer beauty fades away, but inner beauty of character is imperishable and maybe even gets more and more amplified with time. And of course, once again, men have to be educated to this too. What are you paying attention to when you look at a woman? What is it that you pay attention to when you're a young man seeking for a bride? Is it the kind of incorruptible character, or is it the temporary, perishable external appearance? Is it the kind of appearance that displays and flaunts the superficial values of the world, or is it the kind of adornment and appearance that says this is a person of character, of dignity, of proper humility, respect for herself and for her husband and for the people in the world around her? Clark Gable had this interesting, well, a lot of quotes. Probably one of the movies, he looks at the woman and he says, I've seen women I'd look at sooner, but none I've looked at long. We need to look at the things that are incorruptible, things that are permanent. Beauty is going to change, but the character, you know, of a person is possibly eternal, incorruptible. As my mother said, you need to find a wife you can look at across the breakfast table for 50 years. This is a long-term proposition. Men are as responsible here in this way as women are. What do you applaud? What are you attracted to in the appearance of the woman? And of course, one of the things that we read here is that it should be gentle and kind. That's the character she should have, and that should be expressed in her clothing. Gentle and kind. And a lot of women, you know, they look at that and say, well, I don't want to be a doormat. Well, I don't know what you think being a doormat means. That's a word that you probably define down to such a way that being in submission, proper submission to the husband, probably is what you would think is a doormat. But nobody, of course, is asked to be a doormat, but we are asked to submit ourselves to other people. Submit yourself to the government, even if it's unfair. Submit yourself to your boss, even if it's unfair. Submit yourself to your husband, even if that's unfair. You submit yourself, and you're gentle and quiet about it. You don't just continually raise arguments about that. And a lot of women would say, you know, I'm just not that kind of person. You know, I know some people that are gentle and kind and quiet in their personal characteristic, but that's not me. Well, I suspect that for some of us, it's harder to develop some of the virtues that God wants us to have than it is for others. Some people are irritable and have a temper. I've already admitted to that. But that doesn't excuse me. We can't use the Popeye philosophy and say, I am what I am, what I am. You can't expect me not to be irritable. No, that's my responsibility to work on that. And if, in fact, you don't have that gentle, quiet kind of spirit by nature, it's something you can work on and develop. That's a responsibility that God has given to the women. And I know we're talking about the women a lot. But we still got this to talk about, too. Obey. 1 Peter 3 and verse 6, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by fear. Obey. We used to do the wedding ceremonies, and that was always part of it. Promise to love, honor, and obey. I don't do many wedding ceremonies anymore because, I mean, people don't want to have those, you know, vows. And I'm like, well, you know, I think that's what the scriptures say. And if you want me to perform the wedding ceremony, that's what we're going to do. And that's the commitment that I hope you're willing to make. And that's the one I'm going to ask you to make. But obey seems like a harsh word and unfair in this modern world of feminism and women's rights. What this word really means is to hear from under. It is the kind of respect that a soldier gives to the officer, the kind of obedience that is not just a sullen, okay, he told me to do this, now I guess I gotta do it. It's the kind of listening carefully to see what is your responsibility. It means, I think, in this case, not just doing what's directly ordered, but to do what the other person needs you to do, even maybe before they've had to give you the order about that. It means that being attentive to his needs, looking up to see what it is that you can do to make this relationship better. Very frequently, in discussing this topic, whether in Ephesians 5 or in chapter 3 here, we have people who will say, well, if he loved me, he wouldn't order me to fix his dinner if I don't talk every day. And their response, I think, appropriately is, if you loved him, he wouldn't have to tell you to do that. You would recognize that's what he needs, that's what he wants, that's what he appreciates, and you'd be delighted to do that. It's listening attentively, looking up attentively to meet his needs. Yeah, and I know I probably lost 25% of the audience at this point. That's what it says, and that's what it means. And you can't set it aside just because you don't feel like that's a good idea. And really, here's another point here. That a lot of times, women are concerned about that because they're afraid they're going to put themselves in the power of a man that is going to abuse them. But in this case, It means to do it without being frightened. To do it without being frightened by any fear. He emphasizes that point. You marry a person you have faith in, that you trust, enter into this kind of relationship with. And if you have entered into this covenant relationship, if you pledge yourself to a man who is not the kind of man that you should have chosen, and now you find out, then you got to remember that's really the context in which Peter is writing this. Likewise, the same as if you were working for a government and you need to honor the governors even though they're immoral. The same as if you've got a boss or a master who's mistreating you, you still have to be in submission to that. Same as if you are in a personal relationship, and somebody is mistreating you, you have the responsibility not to seek vengeance, but to do what is best for them and their soul. And clearly that's the case when we're talking about the relationship between a wife and her husband. Obed, just like Abraham's wife, Sarah. Okay, you'll be happy. We're going to turn and talk about the husbands in this one. Of course, you might be unhappy when you recognize that there's only one verse. Maybe that's because husbands don't need that much correction. Maybe that's because husbands can't take but so much correction. But one verse is pretty packed field. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. You husbands, in the same way, may not be fair. You may wish you'd have gotten another wife. Doesn't matter. This covenant relationship, you pledge yourself. In the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman. And show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered. One verse here to admonish the husbands. And it summarizes so much stuff. Live with your wife. Live with your wife. And the husband said, well, I do. Yeah, I'll come home every night. My clothes are in the closet. My truck's in the driveway. Well, that's good. That's good. But a better translation here, other than just live, is to dwell with. There's an idea of familiarity here. There's an idea of sharing here, and this idea of live together. A closeness that very frequently is missing in marriages, and women miss that very frequently more than men do. You need to live with your wives. You need to make them feel like that you're living with them, that you have this familiarity with them, that you share with them. And part of that, as we discussed in the morning hour, is you got to talk to them, because that's the common complaint of wives. Maybe that doesn't really get to exactly the issue, but it expresses the sense, my husband is not here with me. He doesn't share with me. He doesn't dwell with me in this house in the same sense. Wives say they don't talk to me. What they mean is, you know, we just don't share things together. You can do this experiment. Go and drive up and down Fowler Avenue or 56th Street, stop at the red lights, you know, and they just pack up traffic and look over in the cars. And you see this young couple over here, they're just chattering away at one another. And then you see this middle-aged couple over here, they're just sitting there. Dating, married. But you got to keep that up, you know. When you get married, you got to keep talking to one another. Husbands need to be involved in what's going on. It's not just the home that provides hotel services, maid service, meals, and everything else. This is a family that you're a part of. And you need to put some time and effort into that. I know some guys and they spend a lot of time in their yards. And maybe I'm just justifying this because my yard's immense, you know. And some people ask what my address was, and, you know, and they drive by and okay, I'm embarrassed. But, you know, that's something maybe you ought to pay more attention to than I do. But the real issue is not spending all that time and effort on the house, on the yard, but do you spend that time and effort on the home? To create a home and to make a house a home. All of that suggests, you know, this is a responsibility of men very frequently because of the nature of the psychological difference between men and women, the nature of society, that men have to focus on much more than a woman has to focus on. Living there, making it a home. If you want to settle for a mediocre marriage, that's okay. That's what you get. You're not going to have the kind of connection, emotional support, joy, and love in your family relationship that most of us wish for without putting some work into it. It's like any living thing. If you don't tend it, it's going to wither up and die. You need to constantly be working on this relationship. I read this biography about some famous writer, and you know, he had married an exquisite beauty, popular socialite, and then things kind of went bad. And they were asking about that. And at the end of life, he expressed his regret. You know, he said, "Here we are at a social gathering, and I look at my wife, who formerly was bright, vivacious, cheerful, involved with everything, and I see her now, gray, withered, and sad, over in the corner by herself. And I have to think to myself, I made her that way." We have an enormous impact on her. Wouldn't it be so much better to husbands to see your wife, you know, vivacious, energetic, cheerful, concerned about other people, involved, and to feel like to some small extent, I made her that way. That was something I contributed to. That's what we ought to be aiming for in our relationship with our wives. We need to invest in them. He also says here about husbands that they need to provide the kind of leadership in the household, active involvement. They need to be a part of what goes on. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, when he talks about the qualification of elders, says one who rules his house well. Sometimes we read that word, and I think, you know, sometimes these translations mislead us because the people who made the translation misunderstood it or wanted deliberately to mislead us about what that means. Rules his household, immediately invokes this kind of sense that the man, you know, trots hard heel down the hallways of his home, intimidating this one, intimidating that, and commanding everything. It really means manages his household. It means to get the best effort out of others, to know how to get people to do useful work, to know how to get them to work together. It is the, you know, the research that we spend so much time on these days. What is leadership? What's the best way to be a leader at work? What's the best way to be a leader in your home? You need to be thinking about how I'm going to get my children and my wife to live the right kind of lives, to be the right kind of productive people. It's not a matter of bullying and forcing people, getting them to obey. It's a matter more like gentle persuasion and forming and developing and providing the right kind of example. You make the wife's responsibilities of respecting you so much more difficult when that's the kind of person that you are. Maybe you will get obedience, probably not. But what you will surely get is resentment. That's why he goes on to say you should live with them with understanding. The success of a marriage depends a great deal on the extent of the husband's ability to understand, to sympathize, to empathize with his wife. Just because of the nature, psychologically, of men and women, and because of the kind of societal training that we still provide differently for men and women, most women enter into a marriage relationship with adequate kinds of emotional empathy skills. They know what other people are feeling much better than many men do. They know how to respond in such a way that's encouraging more than many men do. I think one of the hardest things for me to do is when I go to visit people that are sick or suffering in some ways. You know, maybe thankfully I can be like Job's friends in the first part of the book of Job and just sit there silently with them and encourage them that way. But when it comes down to what do you say to them? How do you, what kind of things do you do to encourage them? I have some difficulty with that. My wife's much better at that. Most women are much better at that. They understand people's feelings and they know how to respond to them in such a way that's helpful. They understand their husbands better than their husbands understand them. We could do this kind of test. Ask the wives, you know, what kind of clothes does the husband prefer, what sizes, how does he like his coffee, you know, what kinds of things aggravate him. And she's probably got a pretty good list. She knows that. ask the husbands, you know, what size is your husband, your wife wear? What are her color preferences? You know, it's like go to buy gifts on gift giving the season occasions. I'm like, I should know this. I should know this, but I really don't know it. Really, I ought to know it. Hopefully, I do understand the kind of things that she needs me to say to her to encourage her, the kind of things I ought not to say that would discourage her. You know, we need, maybe in the reverse of the song, I don't know, the movie escapes me in a moment, maybe not, you know, why can't a woman be more like a man? Maybe the thing in marriage is, why can't a man be more like a woman? Why can't he understand in the way that the wife understands him? That's the job that you husbands have, a responsibility. You have to learn to be considerate of her, and to be considerate of her, you have to empathize with her, you have to understand her. Men who say, I just don't understand my wife. Well, you know, that's maybe true, probably is. But you can't just say that and let her. God says to you to understand your wife. You got to talk to her. You got to think about it. You got to figure it out. You got to understand your wife. And you got to honor her. Do you give her honor in the relationship? It's always the greater responsibility of the leaders to reward, to encourage, and to honor those who work for them. It's the greater responsibility of the husband to work at trying to understand his wife and to honor her, to show them the respect and appreciation that they deserve, not to treat them like a slave, not to pay attention to the fact God said for you to obey and be in submission, but to concern themselves with the fact God said, I need to live my life with understanding, to honor her because she's valuable. She's the most valuable thing in your life. If you've got a wife, if you've got a good wife, like Proverbs 31, that's better than jewels. That's better than anything else. Married men are happier, wealthier, and healthier than single men, even when they're just kind of mediocre marriages. Married men benefit much more from the marriage than the married women do. Your wife is the most important thing in your life. You need to honor her for that. Because the way in which she conducts herself is directly going to contribute to the kind of person that you are. You're not just a provider in the household. You're a husband, a lover, a supporter, and you've got to invest yourself in that. Your wife didn't marry you for your paycheck. I hope, at least in my case, I hope she didn't. Maybe I misguided. She didn't know I was going to work hard in college. But that's not the case. I mean, marriage is not about that. It's about the kind of relationship we have and the support that we provide for one another. You should honor your wife. And part of that is to treat her as the weaker vessel. And I know, what does it mean that the wife is weaker than the husband? Well, one of the things it means is you're not supposed to be intimidating her or bullying her, because that's clearly implied, and you should treat her as a weaker vessel. I know my wife is in many ways not weak. I've been with her through birth of four children. I understand how strong she is. In fact, we're getting to the point in life, you know, sometimes I'm trying to get the cap off the jar, and she'll say, well, let me do that. It's not physically weaker. I think for sure what it is emotionally weaker. She needs more tender care. She needs to be encouraged as opposed to being bullied. We need to be solicitous of her health and her welfare. We need to take our wife's emotional needs into consideration and understand that what we do is going to have a dramatic impact on her, much more so maybe than it would be if we were, you know, roommates with some guy. You know, it's just not the same thing. What are the ways in which we understand about the value of something is when we think we're about to lose it. Just almost lose something. And then you realize how valuable it is to you. And we ought to think about our wife is fragile so that we can honor her. The things that are, I see some guys, you know, they're very concerned about the truck. You know, it's one of the reasons I don't like to buy new vehicles. It's like, you know, you got to, when's the first catch-up?
house going to be spilled, when the first crash is going to get, take care of it because it's so, fragile and delicate and valuable in some place. They're more concerned about their truck than they are about their wife. You know, they just buffet her all day long, every day with various kinds of criticism, various kinds of ignoring her needs. No, she's valuable. You need to recognize how valuable she is and try and preserve her as long as possible. And you should recognize and honor her for this reason too, because we all share together the grace of Jesus Christ. We are heirs together. And Jesus says, Paul says here, the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, that your prayers are hindered when you don't have the right relationship with your wife. In fact, we understand that in general terms. If you come to make your sacrifice before the Lord, come to offer your prayers, you recognize somebody's got something against you, go and make that right before you offer your prayers. Surely that would be the case with your wife or your husband. We share together. Let God build your marriage. Psalm 127, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps away from vain. The ultimate purpose, of course, of everything we do in this life, even of our marriages, is to get to heaven. We want to encourage one another in that effort. We want to be happy along the way, rejoicing and singing, gladness in our heart because of the support, the encouragement that we get from those who are nearest and dearest to us. But we want most of all that we should all be at home in heaven together after this life is over. And a part of the work of marriage is shaping our character in such a way that we express Jesus Christ, that we have his character, that we're more and more like him. And when we do that, that's going to make our personal relationships, especially our families, so much better than the relationships